Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
So welcome to LSE for today's event, which forms part of the LSE Festival, How to Save the Planet, and which has been taking place since Monday and will continue until tomorrow, with a series of events that explore what can be done to save the Earth, its people and environment from existential threats, including the climate crisis, conflict, and AI. My name is Marion Dumas, and I'm an associate as a professor or research fellow at the Grantham Research Institute for Climate Change and the Environment here at the LSE. And I'm very pleased to welcome Giles Atkinson, Luca Chancel, Dennis Fernando, and Zefani Ripolo to our online audience and hear people in the room today. So Giles Atkinson is acting director of the Grantham Research Institute on Climate Change and the Environment and professor of environmental policy and LSE's Department of Geography and Environment. And his expertise is sustainability economics and the economic appraisal of environmental policy. Luca Chancel is associate professor of economics at Sciences Po, and he's affiliated with the Center for Research on Social Inequalities in the Department of Economics. He's also co-director and senior economist at the World Inequality Lab, which produces a lot of publicly available resources that you may have already encountered, which is hosted at the Paris School of Economics. And his work focuses on global inequality and ecological transitions and the tight interplay between these. Dennis Fernando is a senior rights and justice campaigner at Friends of the Earth, and he's working on the right to protest, anti-racism, international solidarity, and adaptation to extreme weather. Before working at Friends of the Earth, Dennis was an activist in the Occupy London camp, Stand Up to Racism, and the Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Zefani Ripolo is Southeast Asia Director of Just Associates and a Senior Atlantic Fellow here then at the LSE for Social and Economic Equity. She works at the intersection of women, land, and environmental justice, advancing feminist and grassroots leadership across Southeast Asia. And her work centers on feminist movement building, self-determined development, and regenerative economies. So we will be exploring now the deep links between climate change and inequality, both within and between countries. And so the discussion will ask how environment, economic, and social policy can work together to ensure that climate action reduces rather than exacerbate inequalities. For those social media users in the audience, the hashtag for today's event is LSE Festival. It would ask you to please put your phones on silent so as not to disrupt the event. The event is being recorded and will hopefully be made available as a podcast subject to technical difficulties, which rarely happen. Each of our speakers will share their reflections for about 6 minutes each, and then you will have a chance to ask your questions. For an online audience, you will be able to submit your questions via the Q&A feature of the webinar. Please include your name and affiliation. And for those who are here, I will let you know when we'll open the floor for questions. Raise your hand, wait. You know, you'll get the mic. And please let us know your name and affiliation and keep it brief. So, we will try to take as many questions as we can, but we just have 1 hour. So I will now give the floor to Luca Chancel for his remarks.
Thank you very much for the invitation and good afternoon, everybody. So the question is, can we tackle climate change without deepening inequality? And I wanted to start by saying that climate change and maybe more generally pollution is a problem of winners and losers. And by saying this, I'm largely referring to a very influential paper for some of us published in 1994 by American economist Jim Boyce, where basically says that pollution happens because there are winners. Otherwise, it's a trivial problem. It's easily solved. But for it to be called pollution, there must be losers. And note that there are two caveats to this. Losers don't necessarily exist as of now. They might exist in the future. They're not necessarily human beings. And losers might not necessarily be aware that they are losing. Another caveat I would say is that to some extent, we all win and we all lose a bit from climate change, but clearly not in the same way. And a big part of my work has been trying to better understand these dynamics in part out of frustration of what I saw within economics and social sciences as relatively little engagement with environmental issue, with climate issues. And conversely, in environmental sciences and climate science, relatively little engagement with these dynamics of winners and losers, with this political economy of pollution. So I think there has been some progress over the past years, and in fact, decades, or maybe two decades, which you can actually quite well see in the evolution of IPCC reports. And in the past, in the latest IPCC report, AR6, you see the growing recognition of climate change as an inequality problem, not just between countries, not just between generations, but also within countries and within generations. Now, where do we go from these introductory statements? Well, I think that the first thing is that we need good measurement of these inequalities. We need to assess them properly. And I think, again, here, there's been some progress over the past years. With some colleagues, we try to contribute to some to this work, to better map environmental inequalities and climate inequalities along three dimensions. And the first one is the inequality of who pollutes. So dimension number one, when we're talking about inequality, first is who is contributing to pollution. The second dimension is who is impacted by pollution. So who is losing? And the third dimension, which I think is also very important and on which I think even more work is going to be required, is inequality in capacity to cope with the transition itself, capacity to act. And along these three dimensions, I just wanted to flag three key numbers that seem important to me. Out of some recent work on the matter. So inequality in terms of contributions, there are several ways to think about how individuals, groups, countries contribute to pollution. One of them is the inequality associated with the consumption of goods and services that people require to sustain their standard of living. And when you look at these inequalities, the top 10% of the world population represents about 50% of global emissions, and the poorest half represents about 10% of total emissions. Now, in terms of the inequality of impacts, in our climate inequality reports with my colleagues of the World Inequality Lab, we try to measure the concentration of relative income losses with respect to climate change. So how much you're going to lose relative to your initial income level. And what we show is that there's a huge concentration of these relative income losses among the bottom half of the world population. About 75% of all losses are concentrated among the bottom. And then the third dimension, which is the inequality in capacity to act, there are many ways to think about that. But maybe one good proxy here is the distribution of wealth itself. You know, financial power, wealth, you know, ranging much more beyond the realm of economics as power, ability to act in society. And here, if you look at the global level, you have half of the population that owns just 2% of everything there is to own on the planet. And you might think that this is, you know, just a global problem and you have poor countries and rich countries. But in fact, this inequality is also very stark within countries. In a country like the UK or France, the bottom 50% of the population owns barely 5%. So half of the population, about 5% of everything there is to own in these countries. So, you know, when we think about climate and inequality, we really need to also address this structural inequality in capacity to act. And I think that a lot of the policy responses that we might want to think about need to integrate that and not just think about, okay, let's put a carbon tax, see the inequalities it creates, and then let's try to compensate losers ex post. I don't think that's the right approach. And alas, this has been the approach that has been followed over the past decade. And maybe I'll stop here for the moment.
Sounds great. Yeah, thank you. Giles.
Well, thank you very much and for getting us off to an excellent start. And I think you're exactly right about this this dimensions of inequality. So I think in the climate change context, this is incredibly important. So I have 3 points I want to make kind of based on research I've done over the years. The first point I wanted to make was based on surveys that I've done of the public and what people, you know, what we think as the public about these inequality and equity issues. And I think the thing I learned from that is that actually, when you ask people what is fair about these various dimensions of climate change, they're actually quite pluralistic in terms of conceptions of fairness. And I think that's important for one of the questions in the framing for this session, which is how you build this public support, how you get these coalitions for public support for action on climate change. So I'll give you one example. Myself and a colleague, Toby Cruz, a few years ago, we did a study of international adaptation finance. So essentially, it's your inequality and ability to cope, I guess, there. Many countries are going to have to face the consequences of climate change that they did very little to cause. So there's a clear moral imperative for the global community to fund climate adaptation in these vulnerable countries. And what we looked at was an example of UK households and what they thought that fund should look like in terms of whether they would be prepared to make a contribution. Now, the bad news here was that that adaptation fund, people's willingness to contribute is well short of what the UK would actually need to contribute in terms of its share of what was then the sort of a newly formed adaptation fund. I think one of the conferences of the parties agreed on this. But one of the things that we find in our survey was that there's very different constituents of people. We talk about public. It's not just one homogenous group of people, a single block. So we did have about quarter of our example were people who were largely skeptical about climate change. So they believed also that poverty was largely a matter of individual responsibility. So they didn't have strong distributional preferences at all. But they were just one quarter. So that means the remaining three quarters actually wanted to do something about the problem. But they were kind of different as well. We had a group of globally minded people who did respond to information we gave about vulnerability of people adapting to climate. But they also wanted reassurance that the spending would be effective as well. And we had another group of people who had really strong preferences, about a quarter again, really strong preferences for distribution, especially that richer households should pay and that other stakeholder groups like industry should be contributing explicitly as well. So the lesson I take from that is building public support for adaptation finance in this example. It's a bit of a communication challenge, but it's also a design challenge as well. It's about what that adaptation fund needs to look like in order to build a coalition that would support it and get the sufficient funds to actually meaningfully finance adaptation. The second point I wanted to make is about carbon taxes. And it's about this perception, which is a reality, that carbon taxes can in many respects be unfair. So this observation is usually made in high-income countries. Carbon-intensive goods like fuels and so on are necessities. So they tend to hit disproportionately low-income households. But a piece of research that I just published this year with a colleague from Sweden, Julius Anderson, what we argue is that regressiveness, it's a problem, but it's not an inherent feature of the policy. It's a symptom of something else, which essentially is the underlying income equality and the way that changes over time. So we look in particular at the case of Sweden. So Sweden has a carbon tax. It's had it since 1991. But Swedish society has changed very much during that period. Income inequality in particular has changed considerably. So what's happened there, it's not that the carbon tax has been changing dramatically over time. There has been some changes. It's that the gap between the top and bottom of the income distribution, for example, has been widening. And that's amplified any unfairness of the tax. We also found similar evidence across other OECD countries as well. Now, in our paper, we make some, I suppose, reasonable-minded proposals. We talk about revenue recycling, we talk about compensation, etc. But actually, you might say that's a little bit unambitious, because what the bigger problem might be is the income inequality context in the first place. So it's not necessarily about the carbon tax being unfair. It's the fact that you've got this growing issue of income inequality that is maybe the more direct but more challenging lever, but perhaps a more honest approach to face up to. Last point. It's just a quicker one. And I think it relates to your wealth inequality point, Luca, is that there is also a risk in this that we might create new sources of inequality, or at least old sources of inequality coming back to the surface. So I think in particular here, the one that intrigues me is about nature finance, for example, paying landowners, land managers for carbon sequestration services. This is a great idea. It's a real way of trying to tackle climate change. However, if you've got a context of highly unequal land ownership, I did a paper with a colleague, Paolo Rivando, a few years ago, where we looked at Scotland, incredibly uneven, unequal distribution of land. You're reinforcing a wealth inequality. And I don't think we've really thought enough about whether we should be comfortable with that or not. And I'll leave it there. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you very much, Giles. Seth, it's your turn.
Yeah. So let me bring you to Southeast Asia. For far too long, the climate debate has been dominated by market-based, debt-driven, and profit-oriented approaches to reduction of emission, to adaptation, to renewable energy infrastructure, framing the crisis primarily as a business transaction and a source of profit, ignoring the political and economic conditions that drive the crisis and determine who bears its cost, while reproducing the very system that created climate injustices in the first place. These are not substitute for accountability. Climate change is not our abstract, distant future threat. It is a lived reality for millions of people today, particularly for rural and indigenous women in Southeast Asia. In the Philippines, where I come from, it is rebuilding homes after yet another devastating typhoon. In Indonesia, it's defending forests and mangroves from extraction and land conversion. In Cambodia, it means coping with droughts that leave fields unproductive and families struggling with debt. In Myanmar, it means surviving floods and cyclones while already living with conflict and displacement. These impacts are felt collectively across borders. Women often absorb the consequences through longer hours of work, loss of livelihoods, and greater responsibility for caring for their families. At the same time, these same women are being criminalized and threatened for defending their land and territories. But this is only one part of the story, because just as important is the fact that women across the regions are also leading climate solutions that builds their capacities to withstand climate impacts. Indigenous women in the Cordillera in the Philippines and Batambong in Cambodia are leading the preservation of traditional seed varieties and farming practices that strengthens food security and biodiversity. Mm-hmm. Women in Kalimantan, in Maluku, and including Papua are defending forests and mangroves in Indonesia that protect communities from climate disasters. In Sabah, Malaysia, the indigenous communities have led renewable energy initiatives, including community-based micro hydropower systems, demonstrating that the energy transition can be locally controlled and aligned with indigenous self-determination. In Sagaing region and Chin state in Myanmar, women network are the first responders when disaster strikes, providing support long before formal assistance arrives. The problem here is not a lack of local solutions. The problem is that climate solutions are too often imposed on people's lives in ways that excludes their realities. We see conservation projects that restrict indigenous practices. We see carbon offset schemes that commodify our forests and promotes monocrop plantations. We see renewable energy projects that perpetuate violence and displace communities in the name of development. When these so-called climate solutions land in the bodies and experiences of communities at the front line, they can end up deepening inequality rather than addressing it. We must also remember that many of these approaches model and carry a colonial legacy of imposition and extraction. The wealth accumulated in the global north has been built through centuries of colonial extraction and the disproportionate use of the earth's resources. Yet institutions in the global north, including those in the land where we stand and gather today, continue to be connected directly or indirectly to industries such as the British Petroleum that profit from the climate crisis and from extractive activities affecting communities in territories and in places globally like Papua. Climate inequality cannot be separated from these colonial legacies and histories of unequal responsibility carried up to the present. If we are serious about climate justice, then the Global North owes the Global South more than just solidarity. It must reduce emissions. It must critically examine and, where appropriate, divest investments in fossil fuel industries operating across global territories. It owes material support to the Global South. It means accessible and grant-based climate finance and not additional debt. It means funding for adaptation as well as loss and damage. It means technology transfer and support for indigenous land rights. It means protecting the policy space that countries and communities need to pursue development pathways they define for themselves. Now, this is where feminist movement building comes in and why it matters. Not just as another social justice agenda, but as a clear climate strategy. Feminist movements create collective power among those most affected by overlapping systems of oppression, patriarchy, colonialism, racism, imperialism, and economic extraction. They support women's leadership, strengthen community resilience, and challenge development models that prioritize extraction over care. This is not separate from climate adaptation. It is what makes their resilience and adaptation initiatives more effective. Adaptation works best when women have secure lands and territories, have access and control over resources, and have meaningful political participation and the ability to organize collectively, because what makes them more stronger keeps them safe. In practice, this is self-determination, the ability of communities to define their own futures and govern their own lands and resources. So can we tackle climate change without deepening inequality? Yes, but only if it centers the lived realities of the global north and the majority world, particularly rural and indigenous women, strengthen feminist movements, respect self-determination, and address the obligations of the global north. Can climate action become pathways towards both ecological sustainability and social justice? But the key question, I think, this afternoon is not just about if we can tackle climate change without deepening inequality. It's really how willing and ready we are to transform the political and economic conditions and structures that perpetuate violence, that push people to climate vulnerability and increasing inequality in the first place. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Stephanie. Dennis, your turn.
Thanks very much. And really, really powerful speeches to have to go after. So FOE's successful campaigning led to the Climate Change Act. It meant sweeping changes. And one of the things I want to talk about was the limits of top-down policy, having been very involved in that very important act, because successive governments have not fully committed nationally and internationally to making the changes needed to meet the challenges of climate change. The last government's plans to meet the Act's targets were found to be unlawful. And we know that because we exposed the government in court over their inadequate plans twice. The failure to meet targets is a problem globally. The latest CCC report envisions scenarios of a 2-degree rise in global warming by 2050 and 4 degrees by 2100. And it is those facing inequalities, disabled people, lower socioeconomic groups, people of color, especially when thinking internationally of the global majority based in the South, that are already being hit hardest and fastest. In Britain, 10,000 people a year would die in higher heat if we hit 2 degrees by 2050. And the scenarios for 2100 has unthinkable consequences both for here and the rest of the world. One theme I will return to: if we reorganize society to protect impacted communities now, we would all benefit from a safer future by scaling up solutions that lead to a more stable world. These benefits include renewable energy, nature-based solutions that benefit well-being, and billions saved from the global damage that each degree in temperature rise would cost to people, the environment, and the economy.
We stand for the right to protest these injustices which are being restricted, and we are pushing back in court cases. The courts are a crucial tool to hold governments to account over inaction. The government's National Adaptation Plan, which is meant to protect us from extreme weather, is inadequate, so we are taking the government to the European Court of Human Rights. The case features two co-claimants, Doug Pawley, who is disabled and lives in a care home where he's impacted by heat waves, and Kevin Jorda, whose home was demolished as it was threatened by coastal erosion. We work with people like this on the front line of climate impacts who are speaking their truth to power. Last year, we intervened in the appeal of five Just Stop Oil activists who were jailed for up to 5 years for joining a Zoom call. And the sentences were reduced. But the landscape on protest continues to deteriorate, with further laws being passed and activists criminalized. Up until recently, it was unheard of to give jail time to peaceful protesters. We cannot leave the climate crisis to be solved by those in power. And we have to stand up for our rights to protest against them failing us on the climate crisis. If only they would pay more attention to the problem instead of rounding on those who call it out. I want to go on to say what grassroots organizing adds. The environmental movement alone cannot answer the challenges of the climate crisis. The fossil fuel industries are in and out of the corridors of power and are influential in mainstream advertising revenue and the ever more reactionary social media platforms run by tech bro allies of Donald Trump. In contrast, we stand for community empowerment. Friends of the Earth is part of a network of 200 local groups around the country and part of one of the biggest environmental justice networks around the world. Here in Britain, we're running campaigns for better public transport, to defend green spaces, tackling water pollution, and to insulate homes. We are able to use our localized data to empower communities to speak up on flooding and heatwave impacts in their local area. You can search right now on our website for a flooding map and a heatwave map to see not only if you live in areas that are vulnerable to both, but also how it will impact on schools, hospitals, and care homes in your area. This is because we want to make it clear we are a social justice organization alongside an environmental justice one. Mm-hmm. We have a map of energy crisis hotspots of 4.7 million homes at serious risk of hardship, where bills are rising following the war on Iran due to poorly insulated homes. This kind of work means we are able to empower communities, ally with them, and also pre-bunk the toxic narratives that the far right bring to these communities and bring the division that they sow. We must also debunk the myths promoted by the fossil fuel lobby and their political acolytes. Net zero madness is one of them. This month, the CBI's report says net zero is a huge contributor to the economy and jobs in Britain. Net zero business activity currently provides double the amount of full-time jobs compared to the motor vehicle sector and generates more money for the economy than engineering and architecture sector. It is worth more than 100 billion a year to the economy and underpins over 1 million jobs, often better paid than other jobs. The green economy and green jobs are even more important because Trump's war on Iran is causing ongoing destabilization to the global economy, yet Trump's camp is doubling down on oil and war addiction. By amplifying how the green economy is helping people in the midst of rising bills and a cost of living crisis, we can win people over and show that there is a better way. When we stand with those on the front line, everyone benefits. Conversely, if we don't defend and lift up those who face inequality, we can expect the far-right narrative to grow, which blames human rights, migrants, refugees, and even pride flags for the crisis that they have caused. That lets Trump and his billionaire friends off the hook, and they will profit it. They will profit from scapegoating and division, which they have sown. The far-right mobilizations and the community response of the last week have shown how the toxic debate on migrants and refugees has become, where the far-right exploit the horrific attacks on individuals to enact pogroms in Belfast against refugee and migrant communities, and there have been far-right mobilizations around the country. However, in response, we have seen thousands of people out for refugees and nearly a quarter of a million crowdfunded for a women's refugee organization in Northern Ireland. We were proud to be a co-funder of the Together March, which was 500,000 strong and against the far right earlier this year. It was the largest anti-racist demo in history. We need mass movements because the far right are no longer the fringe. They are the mainstream in the US. And that's why we stand with those impacted by the fallout, because it is essential for movements to disrupt that agenda. We march for Palestine and we stand in solidarity with refugees. And we must speak up when the government is complicit with such injustices. We understand that oil wars and climate change are interlinked, that they are decimating lives, livelihoods, and the environment of the countries where people are forced to flee. But Let's not forget that we are starting to see a version of that here too, with people having to internally migrate as their homes are taken by the sea. We stand for justice with them all. There are many reasons to be hopeful, and standing up against inequality goes hand in hand with standing up for the planet.
Great. Thank you very much. And because we have a large audience and four panelists, I don't want to keep you waiting for posing your questions. So we're going to launch right away into a Q&A. Please prepare your questions online. And I will take three questions at a time, alternating between the theater and the online room. So we have a person behind here. Then we'll go to you. And here.
Thank you so much for the talk. You talked a lot about the injustice design.
Can you give your name and your affiliation, please?
Felicia, and I'm from history. You talked a lot about the climate injustice when it comes to long-term development trajectories. However, in Ukraine right now, the climate injustice is very much directly linked to the Russian aggression. It has caused immense damage not only to our environment, but also to neighboring states. So my question would be, who should bear the costs? How realistic would it be in the current climate to bring the aggressor to pay for the acts of ecocide? And if not, what are the alternatives? Yeah, who should be paying? Development institution, climate finance, etc.
Right. We have one person here.
Hello, I'm Vogue. I work for Disability Rights UK on the Everyone's Environment Programme, which is essentially tackling this issue. I was just wondering if we think there's a bit of a framing issue. I mean, even looking at the title with the can we tackle climate change without deepening air quality, and whether we can deflect it to think about how green policy does, as talked about by Dennis at the end, how it does tackle inequality and how that's positive. I think particularly in a lot of communities, particularly marginalised communities, there can be real issues with seeing how climate change is relevant and how it impacts them. And I think green policy has absolutely massive shape the future in a way that, yeah, tackles inequality. So let's hear a bit more about that.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
We had a question here behind the green t-shirt.
Hi, I'm Sergio. I'm doing my master's in environmental economics and climate change, and I also work here at the Just Transition Finance Lab. So my question is for Luca. My dissertation, I'm studying the empirical correlation between the top 1% wet accumulation and CO2 emissions per capita. And it's quite clear that the correlation is positive, but what is less clear to me is exactly what is the transmission channel. So it can be, for example, luxury consumption, but it also can be the asset ownership or political power that comes from that asset ownership to influence the climate agenda. So my question is, how can we isolate these channels in general, but also like econometrically?
Great. So a question on who should pay for the ecocide war generated by wars. And it's a Russian example, but we have major ecological fallout, climate fallout from the Iran war, for example. How do we bring aggressors to account? Anybody cares to take that question? Maybe the campaigner in the room is.
Yeah, I'm happy to have a go. So I think that overall, we are moving into a phase in the world where we must have global dialogue, not conflict. That has to just be the beginning point of absolutely everything. So like wars are going to cost us the price of the future, because the amount of money that is put into wars, the outlet, the impacts of them in terms of the emissions, the running of the US Army, for example, is the equivalent of an entire country. So it is absolutely essential that we have this founding principle that in order to tackle the threat of climate change, which at its worst is going to be existential for us. We have to stop contributing to the damage that we're doing to people and planet. In terms of who should pay, I think it's really interesting that the COP targets are set every year, they're reiterated every year, they're not met. And that really does have to happen, because if you look at the interlink between the developed world and the war machine, it is very, very close, and the fossil fuels industry is often very much in the middle. So we would say the polluters should pay, the developed world needs to do its part. The events of the last 2 weeks are staggering when you think that Elon Musk is now a trillionaire, and £1 trillion a year is what is needed, is what one of the things that COP is asking of the developed world. So one person has the same amount of money as the entire supposed contribution of the developed world, but that's not happening. So all of these things are really important that we put into the mix, because they do lead to a better future.
Anybody wants to react?
On the question of reparations, compensations, so polluters, aggressors should be held accountable and should pay financial sanctions. I don't have the answer, and not sure anybody at this table knows the answer to that question of a settlement of this war, of this conflict. Now, what I would like to say is that besides war situations, there's a clear case about how do we make those who benefit financially from destroying the planet accountable for that. Since you mentioned the war in Ukraine, following the invasion of Ukraine, the European Council adopted a regulation 2022-4-28, which basically bans any form of investments by European citizens, groups, companies into Russian oil, Russian gas, or energy-related sectors. Now, why is it still possible today for European Union companies, citizens, investors to invest in new oil and gas fields in other parts of the world that basically we know for a fact that they constitute a major threat to global security, a major threat to global ecosystems, and so forth and so on? And this connects with the other question about the top 1%, their responsibility. Should we look at people responsible as consumers, people responsible as investors, people responsible as citizens? And in fact, we should look at all these dimensions together. And this is basically what the latest IPCC report has recognized, that there's a disproportionate contribution by wealthiest individuals as consumers, as role models, as investors, and so forth and so on. And I think it's really interesting to see that in a situation like a war and sanctions associated with the war, legislators, in particular in the European Union, were able to see that there is some responsibility from investors, from asset owners, and they're telling them, actually, you cannot invest in specific sectors. And I think this is very interesting as an avenue for future climate-related legislations, that basically we have carbon taxes in Europe. We now have a carbon border adjustment, but we don't have legislations that are preventing European wealth from investing in sectors outside, abroad, the European Union, although we know that these are major security, planetary, habitability risks in the future. And this really connects to the point of disproportionate responsibility of the top 1% as investors and not just as consumers. I'm happy to talk about the microeconometrics after the discussion if you want, but the key thing is get micro data, like in Norway, for instance, where you can really look at individual level asset owners and their CO2 emissions, because there is some very interesting data there, but happy to follow up on that.
Okay. Great. Yeah.
Just quick follow-up. I think that there's a law aspect to this as well. So yeah, it'd be really interesting to know the more of the economic data. But Grantham Research Institute has this really neat public access resource called Climate Change Laws of the World. And this makes me think that actually should go this general point about making polluters liable for their behavior. That database essentially gives you a resource of, you know, what laws and legislation is there out there that could bring polluters to account, and also tells us about what gaps there are as well. So precisely, you know, where legislators have missed something as well. So I think just that that sort of law scholarship aspect is really important in this as well.
So we had a question about the flipping a bit the framing and saying not just how can we address climate change without deepening inequality, but actually how can we address climate change in a way that helps redress inequality. So maybe giving a few concrete examples might be a nice way to answer. Who wants to chip in here?
Yeah, I think the question on how the Green Deals have been actually address inequality from where I'm sitting and how we are navigating the climate crisis. And the communities we work with, most often than not, within the economic framework that locates these solutions, it still does not benefit the communities. And maybe I don't have a good news here to something to say. The transition minerals, for example, in the hope of transitioning from fossil fuel to renewable energy infrastructure, these have resulted in massive displacement and violence in communities such as the Philippines and Indonesia for cobalt and nickel. And when these total projects and transition minerals are accounted for, it actually, our question is really, does it equate to the needed renewable energy infrastructure to address climate mitigation or adaptation work? And so still, the answer is that on the ground, these solutions, whether that's another name for another for a Green New Deal or another investment, fancy investment portfolio, it still compromises lives and dignity of women and indigenous communities. And so if we look at solutions still within the current economic frame that puts profit over people's lives, these solutions still sits and position the same way as how businesses are profiting from the crisis. And so how these policies land in bodies and in communities, unfortunately, it still does not put forward the very life and dignity that people are actually fighting for. That's why there's this ongoing struggle against big polluters, and that's why climate justice is being coined, because it's not just carbon emissions in the atmosphere, it's actually actual lives, actual people, human beings that have been lives have been lost for many, many years, and climate solutions have been slower than what is expected and demanded for.
Is there somewhere or some examples of more of a good news.
Like
of moving in the right direction in terms of tackling both at the same time? I don't know. Yeah, Nika.
Since you mentioned the Swedish carbon tax earlier, in fact, Sweden was one of the earliest countries to introduce a modern carbon tax, the early 1990s. But actually, they started to address climate change in the energy sector, in particular in the heating sector, in the 1970s. Not with a carbon tax, they did massive public investments at the municipal level in urban heating networks. Mm-hmm. So basically letting everybody having the capacity to change from the fuel heating system they had to a low carbon source, because this is urban heating fueled by renewable energy, biomass, etc. And so I think this is really one of the examples where you see that you have some form of reduction of inequalities, because you create a public service, in that case at the municipal level. This is a municipally owned infrastructure, so it belongs to everybody. And basically, it was very successful, fairly efficient at reducing CO2 emissions in the heating sector and at making sure that everybody would have access to this relatively low energy source. So this is really kind of flipping the framing. Mm-hmm.
Right. Can I just add a bit? I think the good news is not within the policy space. The good news is that there are movement initiatives and communities that are not waiting for any policy to be to happen. And I think I mentioned earlier in what we've discussed, there are microhydro systems that indigenous communities are actually doing and continue to do. There are urgent response networks in contexts where there's actually displacement that women are able to respond and support each other. There are very important traditional seed preservation that's happening. And all of these happen because people care. They do not wait for policy to shape and put center their life and dignity given the crisis.
Mm-hmm. Chris, yeah, Giles.
Yeah, I think it's not hard to find examples of where climate action helps rather than exacerbates inequality. Yeah, I just think of adaptation investments. I think that helps equality and equity precisely because it's addressing a way in which climate change damage is deepening inequality. I still quite like the framing because I think it's very salient at the moment. So it's a relevant question for us to address. But thinking about the comparison, it's not whether on its own climate change action deepens inequality or otherwise. The comparison is with the way in which climate change damage is going to also deepen inequality. So we should always have in mind what we're comparing here. Well, a reference point is.
So when we did the National Adaptation Plan, we worked very closely with disability activists, and this involved going to the High Court we were very much wanting to ensure accessibility in the court, one of the most basic things. And we were actually told from disability activists that we worked with that this was the first time that their needs were recognized, both in terms of even the kind of security check when you're going into the court and some of the experiences that they've had there. But even little things like the fact that a teller walks into the room and says, "All rise." And we had to criticize that and said, "Well, we've got wheelchair users here." So they then changed their wording and said, "No, we'll say all rise if you can," and that kind of thing. So I think that it is possible if you approach this problem with that framing, and that you're going to, the most important thing is that we have to ally with other people's struggles. So we're not experts on disability justice. We have to talk to experts and activists on disability justice, and we have to say our struggle is your struggle. So I think that that's one thing. I think that it is possible for climate policies to have an impact. You just look at the clean air emission zones and these kind of things, which save lives as a result of bringing down emissions. And it's important to put these things in the balance. How much more important is it for a car usage compared to people being able to stay alive and working through those particular things? And then just one last thing, which is that the CCC report that I quoted earlier, which said 10,000 people annually dying by 2050, one of the things that they're saying is adaptation of hospitals, care homes, and these places could dramatically take a chunk of those deaths out of the equation. So again, us saying, well, actually, the things that are going to help with in terms of adaptation, the things that are going to help in terms of the responding to the climate crisis will also help those who are most impacted and on the front line.
Great. Thanks a lot for that. I think we can take a few questions from the online audience.
So I'll give three questions from the online audience. The first is from Rosie Clark from the UK climate action charity Possible, who asks, how do we effectively cross the divide and reach climate skeptical or climate ambivalent people who comprise about 50% of the UK population? The second question is from Sam Merry from the Environment Agency. He says, given that developing countries have contributed least to global greenhouse gas emissions, yet face the most severe impacts of climate change, what role can international organizations play in addressing this imbalance? And the third and last question is from Thomas, who's a member of the public, who asks, how do we respond to the arguments of market fundamentalists who argue that there is some optimal level of climate change, the point where the social cost of climate change should equate to the social benefit of climate change?
It's a good one for you.
Great.
All right. So, what can we say to those people who are still skeptical? Maybe not just that climate change is happening, but maybe that we have effective ways of addressing it. Because I think that's a lot of the skepticism comes from a disbelief that we can actually handle it in a way that makes sense. Do you want to?
Yeah, I think it's no longer a debate on how deep the impacts to climate change is when you look at it from the vantage of people from the Global South. In the Philippines in particular, years ago, we have witnessed bodies piled up on the aftermath of Typhoon Haiyan. And for us, this is not something that we still debate on, whether it's happening or whether we should do something about it. And I think the important thing is that to also really connect these realities into the mainstream discourse, into the academic discourse or in different discourse, where lived realities is actually primarily an evidence in itself that speaks about the degree and weight of the crisis. And I think how we understand the dignity and life of people outside our own realm, outside our own community or outside this room is actually as important as my own life or as your life. And so it's really a question on looking at human dignity from in a way on how you also value your life, because it's affecting a lot of people and it's real and it's an everyday reality. And so I think, and it answers on the second question on what role to play in the international community, is to stay alive and connected to these debates and not isolate lived realities of people to the discourse of climate change. Not to remain it as a technical issue, but an issue of survival. And you can't put technicality and a price tag to people's survival, because these are lives and dignity on the line. So I think putting the dignity and humanity back on the subject matter and not just another academic debate.
On the market fundamentalism part, I would say that, you know, it hasn't worked particularly well over the past decades. And if one country is currently cracking some of the dimensions of the problem, it's China. And in China, the approach was fairly pragmatic. So you have carbon taxes in some sectors of the economy, you have markets, you have government intervention. And so it's really not a fundamentalistic vision of what to do. Now, some people would say, yeah, but this is China and this cannot be translated to other countries. Well, in fact, when you look at the climate policies that China has been developing over the past decades, many of them look very much like the kind of industrial policies that European countries, that North America were actually implementing in 1970s, 1980s, and 1960s, in the reconstruction period after the Second World War. And so I think that's really important when we want to think about the future, is really to, you know, stop being fundamentalistic about, you know, what to do, but look at what works. And sometimes just also look at our own history of government intervention and planning in the economy that made it possible to rebuild after World War II and to build strong and innovative economies. Now, on the other question, which was developing countries and role of international organizations, I would say that it's indeed a very, very vast topic. I won't be able to say much on it in 1 minute. I just wanted to flag publication of the Global Justice Report with my colleagues of the World Inequality Lab. That was 2 weeks ago, where we set out a plan for reforms of the international financial architecture, of the international tax architecture, because we argue that if we ask a different question to this one, which is how do we compress global inequality? How do we ensure global convergence of average incomes across the world by 2100? How do we do this under, you know, planetary boundaries? Well, it's going to be very, very hard to do this if you don't seriously address international financial architecture and global tax architecture, because you need resources for developing countries to invest in climate change. And how do you, are you going to do this with the current cost of capital? How are you going to do this with the exorbitant privilege of rich countries, which still have reserve currencies, the euro, the dollar, which basically acts as a transfer from poor to rich countries? So we really need to address that. There are a few initiatives out there. One of them is the Bridgetown Declaration of Barbados. There's also a UN tax convention, which is supported by low-income emerging countries to reform the global financial architecture, voted at the United Nations General Assembly in 2024. There are many initiatives all over Some are connected with the climate discussion, some are not. And I think we do really need to connect them and much more in this Global Justice Report available online.
Yeah, highly recommended. Dennis, do you want to?
Yeah. Are we answering all three of them?
I think they have connections and yes. You can choose one. Sure. So we had crossing the divide and market fundamentalist approach and then the role of international organizations. So
sure. So, well, I think on crossing the divide, I think, and I'm going to talk mainly about Britain here because it's the thing that I'm following the closest is, we have lots of people who have their explanations for the cost of living crisis. The far right say, we can solve the cost of living crisis, get rid of the refugees down the road in the hotel and everything will be fine. It won't be, but that's their simple explanation for things. The truth of the matter is that lots of people in this country are preoccupied with rising bills and then how to take care of their family and the future of their children. They're not thinking about climate change. So we in this movement have to think, how do we appeal to you? The interesting thing is that if you pose the question slightly differently about the polling, if you ask people what solutions should there be to the energy rise, across all parties, there is a favorability towards renewables. So the politicians who are aligned to that need to make the most of that. And make more of it. So I think that's a really important one. I think the other thing we've just got to be always minded of is that the far right debate does not end here. We've got to make it clear that it is a threat to people, even those who are supposedly supportive of it, in terms of their approach to the working class, their approach to different communities. And you only need to look at the fact that the COP30 demonstration, which happened last year in Manchester, led by children, was doxed by the far right, and they did not care that children were leading that demonstration. Now, I think if you talk to people who are tilted rightwards and said, do you think that that's acceptable? Most of them would say no. On the question of optimum level climate change, wow, a phrase I've never heard of before, but very, very interesting one. My family are from Sri Lanka. If global temperatures go to runaway, which if we don't do anything in this critical decade to stop them going over 2 degrees, we lock ourselves into a loop where the Arctic melts, the sea levels rise, and countries like Sri Lanka go underwater. So optimal level climate change, if you live in those countries, that phrase doesn't mean anything to you. It's for people who are not living in those countries and are thinking, oh, if the temperature gets warm here, we can grow avocados. Never mind the fact that the rainforest burns and countries like that go underwater. So we have to challenge the privileges that such things are built on.
Jazz.
Well, you probably know, Marion, more about this than I, but optimum level of climate, it's not a term I've heard it, but not for a while. So I just very quickly, I think economics is a really powerful way for thinking about some of these challenges, but also we have to be modest about what it can and can't do. Optimality is probably one of those areas. It's about doing better with thinking of an economic framing in amongst all these other justice issues that we've discussed today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Rip, I think we might still have, because we started late, time for a couple more questions from the theater, or no? We have to stop? One. Okay, great. Please.
Thank you. I'm Stuti, and I'm doing my master's here in culture, justice, and environment at the Department of Anthropology. And my question is related to your response to a few questions earlier, where you have mentioned about CBAM and
border adjustment mechanism.
Yes, yes. So my question is that, as we know that Europe imports a lot of steel and iron from India, and if the policy will be implemented and if it comes into action, so there will be a lot of taxes imposed upon the Indian manufacturers, as we know that the mining of iron is heavily dependent on unorganized sector or the laborers who are into unorganized sector of India. So do you think that the burden of that carbon tax will eventually go down to those people who are working on the ground? And of course, it might lead into deepening the inequality. Mm-hmm. And if it does, then how this can be solved?
So very fast answer. In the negotiations and the discussion of the carbon border adjustment, the EU was not a homogeneous bloc. There were voices calling for the redistribution of the tax revenues to emerging and developing countries. And that would be my favorite option. And I think the risk, you know, is to oppose blocks, emerging versus rich countries. And the solution is to, to see, like, in such a case, that the EU not being a homogeneous bloc, there can be alliances between a big part of the population of India with a part of the population within the EU who would say, actually, we don't need to have those tax revenues. We're happy that there's a CBAM because we also want, you know, a level playing field for our industries, but the revenues could be redistributed to those workers that you were referring to. And I think that, for me, would be the solution to that problem.
Great. Well, we've covered a lot of ground in just 1 hour. It'd be amazing. Thank you very much for your good questions and for your attention.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.